Merkle Media.
Ashback Fridays here on Macroaggressions, taking you back to November 2021. Episode 179, Planting Flags All Over the World with Doug Casey. Hey, if you're thinking of converting your soon-to-be-worthless Federal Reserve notes into some tangible gold and silver, talk to our sponsor, Wise Wolf. Get in the Wolfpack Auto Buy Program at www.macroaggressions.gold. Now enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Fredita!
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, Macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Odyssey, Rockfin, or YouTube, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We certainly do appreciate our support. If you're just watching this show, there's an audio component to it as well. We do two episodes a week, not just this one video format. So you can check that out wherever you get your podcast. Thank you to our sponsor, C60 Purple Power has been amazing. We're getting into those, colder months here in the Northern Hemisphere. Something to consider. You're probably going to want to get your best coat of armor on. And C60 Purple Power has been amazing for us. I've been using it for the better part of this year. It is a free radical scavenger. It was theorized by Buckminster Fuller back in the 60s and 70s, the idea of a carbon 60 atom. It was finally discovered in the late 80s. The team that discovered it won the Nobel Prize. So there's got to be something good to it. It's been being used by nuclear physicists like Ken Schwartz, the founder of this company, for many, many years to protect himself from cellular damage. And now it's being brought out into the retail market. So if you are interested, go to c60purplepower.com, read up on it, see if it's right for you. If it is, use the promo code MACRO. These statements and products have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, prevent, or mitigate any disease. If you are interested, just go to c60purplepower.com, use the promo code MACRO. And if you are, look, given that we're in the middle of an impending supply chain catastrophe, you might want to start thinking about getting yourself prepared. You probably have been thinking about this well in advance, but if you're thinking about it right now, go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com and take a look at what they've got. They have storable food. You can get a 4-week supply. You can get a 3-month supply. You can get all kinds of things that you need. This is a situation where you're going to want to be a month early than a day late. You don't want to have a fight with some prick in the grocery store over the last can of beans. Okay. Don't do that to yourself. Save yourself the aggravation. Start being proactive instead of reactive, and go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com so that you can take a look and see if there's anything that seems like it might be a fit for you. Well, this episode is going to be a lot of fun because we have a gentleman that I've been following his work for a very long time. Our book that I wrote with Jeff Berwick, The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire. If you look down in the bottom, you will notice that the foreword was written by Doug Casey. He is the founder of International Man. You got to check out that website. He has a great YouTube blog called Doug Casey's Takes, and you might want to go check that out while you still can. He is the author of many books and soon to be a friend of the show. It's Doug Casey, everybody. Hey, Doug, how are you doing?
It's nice to be here with you, Charlie. I'm speaking to you today from close to the beach in Uruguay.
Yeah. I told my mother I was going to be speaking with you and that you were from Uruguay. She said it's a beautiful place. She used to be a flight attendant with Pan Am back in the 60s and said that she didn't get a chance to explore as much as she would like to, but she was definitely envious that you were down there. And she
fantastic. Well, a Pan Am stewardess, they were the cream of the crop back when you could call flight attendant stewardesses. My mother,
without getting choked out by
United Airlines during World War II, in the days when they had to be registered nurses, among other things. Also, like Pan Am stewardesses, they have to be good-looking and single. That's not the case today, of course.
They don't even have to be women today. They can be one of 87.
They're all members of the Teamsters Union today.
Right. Yeah, so we're in an upside down world, and part of the reason why this world is so upside down is that we've let the worst people in the world be in charge of it. And when you do that, when you deputize criminal bankers and psychopaths and you promote them into high society, I suppose we can't really act too surprised when the wheels fall off. Over the last 18 months, we've gone through this whole COVID situation. It's been both frustrating and fascinating to watch it all play out. You have been you've been way ahead of the curve talking about diversification and getting out and spreading your flag, so to speak, into multiple countries. I think in that had always been a great idea in theory, and now after 2020, it's a great idea in reality, and I think a lot of people are starting to examine that. Is it too late for people to start making these plans for a backup plan? Is it too late for a backup plan if you're in the West?
Well, it's never it's never too late, but let's just say that right now we're in a situation that resembles that of Europe in 1939. So look, it's much harder to travel now than it's ever been in the past. Much harder in many ways. I mean, look, times were you could just hop on a plane, and fly anywhere. And with a U.S. passport or a Canadian passport or a European passport, it was visa-free travel to almost all the world's countries.
Right.
It's really no longer the case anymore. You've got to be vaccinated, and the next step is going to be vaccine passports, which I think will eventually be co-opted by the United Nations, and you're going to have an international UN-issued passport. That it's very late in the day, indeed, but not too late. Your assets in one company. Yeah. Okay, fine. But much more important is diversifying politically, because your political risks in the world today are much greater than your financial risks. Mm-hmm. So the answer to the question is, do it now, but do it.
Yeah. You talk about something called digital diversification. What is that? I mean, that sounds like... it sounds like crypto. It sounds like digital identities. It sounds like VP. What is it exactly? How would you describe that idea of digital diversification?
Well, I don't usually use that term, first of all, because I'm not a computer jock.
Right.
I use my computer as a blunt instrument, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I I far, far prefer them on paper than on my computer screen. But, and I wasn't an early adopter of Bitcoin either. I only got into it in 2017, which was a very good year. And I sold it in January of 2018. And crypto has been very good to me then and still. You want to diversify in as many ways as possible. You don't want to act like a plant. It's not a good survival strategy for a human being to be rooted the way a plant is.
Yeah.
You can be easily eaten or uprooted. So diversify in numerous ways, including digitally, of course.
Yeah. And part of that is diversifying, like you said, not being a plant, not being tied to one particular area. That gets us into diversifying out of your nation of birth. And maybe, though you can't change that, you might be able to change the passports that you hold. I know that this has been a topic that I've been really interested in for a long time, just kind of casually watching it as an observer. But now it seems like it's kind of all hands on deck. There's residency programs, there's passport programs, there's buy your own St. Kitts and Nevis type residency. Like, what's a good opportunity or a good option for people that are trying to figure out where they can go to plant an additional flag just so that they have, you know, if this is 1939 Germany or 1939 Europe, you know, obviously you don't have to be a historian to understand how things turned out there. So it's always good to have a backup plan. I think that we look at the people that were in Poland going, oh, they're just being resettled in the East. It's like, you didn't see it coming. You didn't think that maybe, you know, that there was something up. And yet those people are forgotten, or their voices are gone because they're no longer alive after because of their decision. So this is kind of an important, this isn't just like, oh, I kind of want to be by the beach. This might turn out to be a matter of life or death where you are able to go when things get bad. So let's talk about additional passports and residency and things like that. Where does a person even start with something like that?
Well, you start with a lot of travel. Now, I have been to about 160 countries. I've lived in 10. I define living as spending enough time there that you buy property or take a long-term lease on a place to live. Been to most of those countries numerous times, quite frankly. I was born in the U.S., and of course, being born in the U.S. in the middle of the 20th century was like winning the lottery, quite frankly. Best place in the world to be. But it no longer is. The U.S. has degenerated so that to the extent that it's really just another of the 200 nation states that cover the face of the globe like a skin disease at this point, actually having a U.S. passport is a more of a disadvantage than an advantage at this point, because as I'm sure you're aware, are you an American or Canadian or where?
I'm an American, yeah. But having a mother who was a flight attendant with Pan Am, having a dad who had worked at TWA, we travel, you know, so I had the benefit of that.
That's good. That's very helpful. But the U.S. is the only country in the world, the only major country in the world, that reserves the right to tax you even if you leave and you never set foot back in the country again. That's very inconvenient with all the reporting requirements and that. So a lot of Americans are renouncing their citizenship, but for purposes of convenience, you need another one. So where do you go? Now, almost any country in the world, if you go and you live there for 5 years, you can become a citizen. So that's the easy way, cheap way to solve the problem. Some countries make it a lot easier than others. Paraguay used to, no longer. I told people about this several years ago. I said, they're going to close the door. You could get a residence document quite easily, not spend any time there, come back, take a simple exam and become a Paraguayan citizen. Not a bad passport. Incidentally, a good passport is defined by how much visa-free travel is available to you as a citizen of that country. And of course, now there are about, there's about a dozen in the world that sell economic citizenships that you pay them some money, $100,000, $200,000. It can be more. For Malta, for instance, it's $2 million. And they'll grant you a citizenship. So there's lots of ways of solving the problem. Argentina, for instance, has a very good passport. And you can become an Argentine citizen if you only live there for 6 months of the year for 2 years. That's very reasonable. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of ways to do this. But an American or a Canadian should do this ASAP.
Yeah. Yeah. There. You don't want to be the last guy to figure it out. That and we in America, especially, maybe not this audience so much, but the general public gets lulled into this false sense of security. Everything's going to be okay. It's the the boiling pot situation where it's just cranked up a little bit, and so this insanity that has become America has been so incremental that it kind of goes under the radar. You don't really think about it too much until it's too late. When the big debate was talking about Trump building the wall and whether or not he should build it, I was quick to remind people that walls work both ways. You know, there may come a day when we decide that we want to leave this place, and that wall is there to prevent that from happening. But they've set up an interesting sort of hybrid, which is Puerto Rico. You guys at International Man have a component there talking about Puerto Rican tax incentives. Now, this is an interesting one because they've got a situation, if I'm correct, where you can pay like as low as 4% tax. Is that right? Something along those lines. And it has to do with setting up businesses in Puerto Rico.
I don't live in Puerto Rico. I should for tax reasons. But the way it works is that they have two laws down there. Puerto Rico, of course, is just a possession of the U.S. I don't want to go into all the details, but the fact is, if you live in Puerto Rico, and there are some rules about what constitutes that, basically you have to spend 6 months of the year in Puerto Rico, basically. Two things can happen. Number one, all your capital gains are tax-free. This is a big deal. And number two, a business that you set up, properly set up, not a big deal. But if it's run out of Puerto Rico, your income tax works out to like 4%. So that's it, basically. It's not hard to do. I think it's wise to do if you're of a mind. People either like or don't like living in Puerto Rico.
Right.
I mean, there's a reason why in West Side Story, the famous musical, Maria's tour, Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion, let it slip back into the ocean, so that half of the native Puerto Ricans live in the U.S. at this point. It's a horrible place from a lot of points of view, but it's a wonderful place from other points of view. Anyway, look into it.
Yeah.
But still, if you look into it and live in Puerto Rico and get away from U.S. taxes, that's wonderful. But you still need a second passport and a residency outside the U.S.
Yeah. So let's talk about the real estate component to that. That's my background. I work in real estate. So interested in how that works. So you can, it's a sign to this particular country that you indeed mean business. You are bringing capital to them. You are in some ways signaling that you're willing to set down some sort of roots there. They see this as appealing. Is there where do we go if you're somebody that has, you don't just want the citizenship, but you want the real estate component that comes along with that? And I say citizenship, I might mean residency as well, but you want something tangible with a real estate component. Let's get some thoughts on that. What are you liking?
Well, a lot of these countries, especially the Caribbean countries, you can either make a cash contribution to some kind of fund that they set up, which winds up basically being pilfered by individuals in the government, or you can buy certain types of real estate there. It's more expensive. But do you really want to spend a lot of time living in St. Kitts or Dominica or Grenada, countries that do this? Maybe, maybe not. So it depends. But sure, listen, I've owned real estate all over the world, quite frankly, and still do. Look, there's advantages and disadvantages. When I bought my apartment in Hong Kong, it was during a China crisis. And I could buy a penthouse apartment, which I did, for less than I could on the ground floor of the building. My building was just across the road from the Hong Kong Yacht Club. It was a very good location. But why would the penthouse be cheaper? It's because they were afraid. It was a China crisis. They were afraid that the Chinese would not fix the elevators when they took over Hong Kong. Now, that was back in 1986. That apartment was almost free. Wonderful place. $40,000. People can't believe anything can be that cheap in that location today. And that apartment's worth about $1.6 million. So, in the past, so that's the advantage of buying foreign real estate. You can look all over the world and pick up real bargains when there's blood running in the streets. On the other hand, having real estate around the world, it's harder to manage. Real estate is generally a local thing. So it takes experience. And the only way you can really get experience is by going out and starting to do things.
Yeah. 40,000 in Hong Kong. Holy shit.
$40,000 was worth more then than it is now.
Of course.
But still, it was a giveaway. Of course, in those days, 1986, it seems like ancient history to a lot of your listeners, probably. Doesn't seem that long ago to me. That was still at the tail end of the Suzy Wong days and so forth. Hong Kong has been totally transformed now. It's a different place. Very expensive. It's all high rises. It's not the charming place that it once was.
No, I went to boarding school and started boarding school in 86 through 90 in high school. And a lot of the people that I went to school with were coming from Hong Kong. They were in their families were buying up as much as they could get in the U.S. in terms of real estate, because they were scared of the 97 takeover, the turnover, that they didn't know what to expect. So they thought they were going to get out. So then I had a chance to go to Hong Kong a couple of times, and I love it. I mean, talk about a great city. I jokingly would tell people, they'd say, well, do you have a hard time with the language barriers? Man, I think more people speak English in Hong Kong than they do in Los Angeles. You know, you won't have a hard time there. Culturally beautiful place, but that's a perfect example of a place geographically amazing location, pretty interesting. All it takes is to change the government structure, and you take a beautiful shining jewel and turn it into something completely different. And this idea that government comes in and fixes things is so laughable on its face. Look, like, just as an example, we could just show something like along the lines of Hong Kong. So how do you view these sorts of things? Do you view these as buying opportunities? Do you view these, like, how does your investment mind work when you start to see governmental fuckery, for a lack of a better word, that is impacting values all over the place? Does that scare you away? Does that bring you in? Like, how do you view stuff like that?
Well, let me put it this way. We are embarked upon something I call the Greater Depression. What I mean by that is that it'll be like what happened from 1929 to 1946. But it's going to be much worse, much longer lasting, and much different And a depression is a period of time during which most people's standard of living drops significantly. That's a good general definition of a depression. So this is the environment we're working in. And for the last almost a year now, Washington, D.C. and the United States have been captured by a group in Washington. I mean, look, all politicians are horrible. They're criminal personalities. Otherwise, they wouldn't go into politics, because politics is about controlling other people. It's about coercion. But now, with the actual Bolsheviks, actual Jacobins in charge in Washington, and I say that because these are, from a psychological and philosophical point of view, these people are exactly the same people that were in France in 1789 or Russia in 1917. They're actively working to transform the country. Mm-hmm. And of course, people all over the world like them are acting to transform the world. So currencies are being destroyed. The stock market is only where it is because of the printing of trillions and trillions of new currency units. So we're on the precipice of a genuine catastrophe, something that will be of world historic importance. It's very hard to be an investor today for lots of reasons we could discuss. You're almost forced to be a speculator. Mm-hmm. That's the bad news. The good news is if you know what you're doing and can keep the money after taxes, it's going to be wonderful for speculators that know what they're doing. Right. So, but this is a chaotic time we've entered upon. The 20s are going to be, I think they're going to go down in many ways as one of the worst decades in world history.
Wow. So we have that to look forward to. But like you said, and like Jeff and I talked about in the controlled demolition is that as the final chapter in the rubble, in the chaos of it, when it's all cleared away, there's massive opportunities here. There's the opportunity to be on the cutting edge of a transformation of society. If you can position yourself accordingly, is this, are we talking about wealth preservation? Are we talking about wealth creation? Obviously, a combination of both. Where do we find ourselves? Are we buying silver because it's $15 an ounce and it should? And we know that those markets are manipulated. Or are we buying crypto because it's the future? Or are we looking at land because they're not making enough of it? Or are we buying apartment complexes because you'll own nothing and never be happier? Like, what do you see the play here moving forward?
Well, I speculate in commodities in the futures market. I'm a bull on silver, which is, as we speak today, a bit over $24 an ounce, actually.
Oh, good.
And I'm a bull on gold, which, as we speak, is up $30. It's around $1,850. But, and I don't think that these markets are manipulated. Everybody tries to manipulate all markets. That's nothing new. Stocks, bonds, commodities are all, everybody tries to manipulate them, but the powers that be don't care about gold or silver. They're not even rounding errors, and they're philosophically opposed to them. They really do think that gold is a pet rock. Yeah. But so what do you do today? The stock market has been howling. The public is involved in it. I mean, everybody's got a brokerage account. Very bad time to be in the stock market from that point of view. Most of these people are going to get trapped and lose most of their money. That'll present an opportunity some years down the road when you can buy stuff for value prices. I can give you lots of examples of how cheap things can get, much cheaper than anybody believes, just like stocks can get much more expensive than anybody believes. Bond market, a genuine mega disaster in the making. Problem with real estate is it floats on interest rates and borrowed money. Bond prices go down. Interest rates go up. Real estate prices go down. General rule. So now I own a lot of real estate, but not as a speculation, just because you got to put money someplace. Mm-hmm. So where am I mostly? I mean, I specialize, and my specialty has always been resource stocks, mining, and oil and gas. And right now, both of those are really very cheap. And they're teeny-weeny markets. And there's lots of reasons why they're going to go way up cyclically. And so that's where I am mostly.
And how does inflation play into this? Because, I mean, according to the Fed, it's transitory and maybe even non-existent. But of course, they're pathological liars. And we see 40% of all U.S. dollars being created just in 2020. That is, I mean, if you don't even have to, you don't have to have an economics degree to understand that that is foolishness. We've got another here in the United States, another $1 trillion+ spending package for infrastructure. We've got the talk of another one on its back. Inflation, the central bank's game of inflation. There's got to be a way to play it, right? I mean, we know it's coming. They're going to use it to manipulate us. But if we understand this in advance, we've got to either be able to move ourselves out of the way or position ourselves appropriately to sort of benefit from this. So in an inflationary market, like hyperinflationary situation like this, what's a prudent move?
Well, Charlie, the important thing from an individual's point of view is to produce more than you consume and save the difference. That's how you become wealthy. The problem is when governments destroy their currencies, that's called inflation, it makes it very hard to save. Americans save in terms of dollars. The dollar loses value, your savings go away. So what do you do? For many, many years, I've told people, buy gold and silver coins in physical cash form and put them away in the safest place you can think of, which may not be a safe deposit box, incidentally.
Right.
You do that, and you look for opportunities, and you speculate. Now, my specialty in speculation, I've real estate all around the world, just with one exception, has treated me very well. But mainly, I buy mining and oil stocks. And right now they're very, very cheap. So I don't want to get into any specific recommendations. That makes no sense at all. But people should educate themselves in economics and in finance. That means reading a lot of books. That's what you do. You don't take touts. Right. You read books so that you can do your own research. That's much too trouble. Too much trouble for most people. So most people fail at this game. And that's why during a depression, everybody loses money. The winners are just the people that lose the least, generally speaking. And this depression is going to be a doozy. So what can I advise your listeners and watchers to do? Produce more than they consume. Put the difference aside in the safest place you can think of. And hold on to your hat. Diversify politically. You got to write, you know, this is the type of thing you got to read a book about, as opposed to just take somebody's advice because they're talking to you.
Well, you've written some books, and yeah, in these books, you do it in the right way. I'm writing fiction. I'm just writing fictional books about fictional characters that are doing imaginary things. Wink, wink. But there's a lot of truth in what you're writing. The characters may be fictional. The situations that they get in may or may not be fictional. But it's we've covered quite, you know, this on the shows before about how Hollywood likes to put things right in front of your face, but they do it under the guise of this is a fictional movie, but in reality it's predictive programming. So you've been able, and it also gives you the ability to talk about things you're not allowed to talk about, and you can say, well, listen, it's just fictional. You've done that. So let's talk about the books that you've written and your protagonist that gets into these adventures around the world. and how that might not just be a fictional depiction of this, but how you might be able to take these adventures and these stories and look at them in a very real way.
Okay, well, I started out writing nonfiction. My first book was The International Man, a guidebook to making the most of your personal freedom and financial opportunity around the world. I wrote that book a long time ago. The world has changed since then. But among other things, it was the largest selling book in the history of Rhodesia, a record that will never be bettered, incidentally.
No, it will not.
And my second book was Crisis Investing, which became the largest selling book of its era, quite frankly, was during the crisis of the late 70s and the early 80s. But that's fiction. That's nonfiction. I've gotten into writing fiction because there are certain things you can say in the form of fiction that you perhaps dare not say in the form of nonfiction. And a lot of people prefer reading a story, fiction, as opposed to nonfiction, which is reminds them too much of textbooks and such. So several years ago, my co-author, John Hunt, and I wrote Speculator, which I think is very instructive. And I think all your watchers should read that book. Our hero, Charles Knight, starts out as a young man of 23, gets lucky on a mining stock, just gets lucky. These things happen. Sometimes these stocks do go 10 to 1, 100 to 1. Goes to Africa to find out what the story is. Gets involved in a bush war with boy soldiers and so forth. Through one thing and another, he turns his $10,000 stake turned into a million. He turned the million into 200 million. The government steals it from him. It's a great story. A lot of information about mining, about book. It's on Amazon. Then, 7 years later, after running around the world for 7 years, he becomes a drug lord. And this is actually a very interesting book. It explores the drug industry. Like a lot of people of my generation, I almost got into the drug business. Could have, should have, would have, I don't know. I didn't. But I know a lot about it, as does my co-author, John Hunt, who's an MD. So we talk about the drug business, legal and illegal, and how our hero makes another couple hundred million dollars and has it stolen from him, and this time he's put in jail. Brings us up to our third novel, Assassin. And the first line in that book is, some people just need killing. And this book explores the assassin's trade and the morality of killing people and the morality of ethics of political assassination, how it's done, a little bit of revisionist history on various popular politicians that were killed. And now we're working on the fourth one, which is going to be even more radical. So I suggest people not fall behind. These are great reads. They're packed full of practical information. So go on Amazon and get it. Or you can go to highgroundbooks.com and get an autographed copy. So those are the two pathways to these books.
Well, my audience is pretty educated. I get the emails from them, and they're thinking about these things. So this will be a good fit for them because you can, like you said, you can say things under the guise of this being fiction, things that you could never talk about in as a biography, unless you want to wind up going to jail. My dad was approached too, because my dad was a pilot, and apparently he said, well, listen, back then I was approached to do a lot of things, and I turned them all down, and I said, I think I know what you're talking about. He said, yeah.
The thing, like that movie with Tom Cruise about what happened in Mena, Arkansas, on that, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that was an option. And to his credit, he turned it down. I don't know how he did, but apparently he did. So
that's wonderful.
But that's that's fascinating I guess people are going to have to read the book series and try to determine what part of this is maybe autobiographical and what part of this is.
Well, they say that everybody's first novel is always semi-autographical, biographical anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah. They're excellent reads. People will be glad that they read them. So anyway, that's what I'm doing now, in addition to my blog site, internationalman.com, which has lots of practical stuff, and my podcast, Doug Casey's Take on YouTube. Now, why do I do this? I don't have to do anything, quite frankly, but I just find that it's important to work at something, to continue to be productive. Otherwise, you just go to seed and blow away.
Yeah. Well, International Man is great because there's a ton of there's actionable information there. You can read it and you can casually observe it if you want. But then if you make that decision, I need this, or I want to get involved, I want to find out about, precious metal storage. I want to get involved. I want to talk about real estate. You've set up a nice little platform there that people can go to, a kind of a one-stop shop and figure out how they can get their eggs into multiple baskets. I'm curious about,
It's all free. I guess you could say it's pro bono. We don't charge anything. You just go on the site, and I think it's a great site, quite frankly. So
yeah. And you've got the newsletter too. People can sign up and get information about that. You just, in your newest article, you talk about you start off with talking about never let a good crisis go to waste, and the things that were the Rahm Emanuel philosophy that he stole from, this idea that we're going to capitalize on the problems that we currently have as an opportunity to transform society. It's nothing new. It's not a new concept, but here we are looking it in the face. And you went into some detail about NGOs, and Jeff and I talked about that too in the book. Non-governmental organizations, boy, I'll tell you, these really might wind up being a huge component of how things get broken. These groups are extremely dangerous, are they not?
Yeah, they're horrible, actually. And they're a relatively recent phenomenon. You know, people like Ford and Carnegie put most of their huge fortunes into foundations because, well, they wanted to improve, perhaps, I don't know what other reasons they might have had. There weren't very many of them. And of course, either of them would roll over in their graves if they saw what the people that run their foundations have done since then. Because you got a certain type of person that likes to run a foundation the same way as you get only a certain type of person who likes to work for the government or likes to be a politician telling people what to do.
Yeah.
So, but now these things have, there are thousands and thousands of NGOs that they proliferated all over the world. People die, and what are you going to do with their estate? Well, you want to shelter some of it from taxes, so you give it to a foundation. It sounds like it's going to do good things, but they almost always do bad things because of the type of people that run them, okay? We're going to cure world poverty. We're going to clear the landmines. They don't do any of this. They just talk about it. And meanwhile, the executives that run these things live high off the hog. I know. I was on the board of a fairly big foundation at one point, just like I was the trustee of a college at one point, happened to be the 10th oldest college in the U.S. So I've got some practical experience on how these things actually work in these circles. And it actually disgusts me. But I'm not a believer in charity, generally speaking, because charity is it's a misallocation of capital to start with. And it's not sustainable. I hate to use the word sustainable. It's become such a popular word today. Right. The only thing that's sustainable is doing things that make money, that profit, increase capital. When you give money to somebody, like give $20 to a bum, you're probably just cementing him in his bad habits. Okay. Same thing with all these charities. You give stuff to people. There's no proper exchange. And it makes you a mooch and makes them a hustler. So I did an essay. It's about several essays, actually, on charity and why you shouldn't engage in it, or most types of charity. Mm-hmm. But NGOs are institutionalized, this type of thing. They're horrible. And they're minions of governments, always. So just a little rant on why you shouldn't give extra money to charity in general and NGOs in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. They've done some devious things. The Rockefeller Foundation, I think we found, was started as more of a PR hustling campaign to frame them in a different light, be a tax shelter and all that good stuff. And now we've come to be run by them. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Pierre Omidyar Foundation and all of these groups that these guys get together. And we said, well, listen, we're just saving the planet. And it's like, no, you're not. It's a tax shelter, which is fine. I have no problem with that. But let's not pretend that you're out there sprinkling around all this money without massive strings attached. It's become a, and with the climate change hysteria, it seems like they're using these NGOs, like that this is the perfect vehicle to roll out this new climate horseshit that is going to be funded or run by the Club of Rome or the World Economic Forum or a consortium of all of these groups. Where are we going with regard to climate hysteria?
We're going in a very bad place. And the problem is that, kids have been programmed through college, absolutely, where most of the professors are Marxists of some description or another, high school, grade school. They're programmed, they're indoctrinated from their earliest age to believe that mankind is destroying the planet, all kinds of green nonsense. So they believe these things the way Mohammedans believe their religion. It's the same thing. So the world is heading towards a very bad place. And I don't think we can turn it around at this point because history has a momentum of its own. So at this point, all we can do is try to save ourselves until these things collapse of their own weight and hope that civilization itself isn't destroyed in the process. But it was very clever on these people to first come up with COVID, which is a rather trivial kind of flu, maybe worse than most flus, and turn it into something that most people think is worse than the bubonic plague. But compounding that is climate hysteria. And of course, people have been programmed to fear that now for decades. So they're going to pass all these things and huge amounts of tax money and inflationary dollars are going to be directed towards that, which is into the pockets of people that look, this is a very bad thing. So, speaking for myself, I'm adequately diversified. I've got a large ranch here in Uruguay, large ranch in Argentina, got stuff in the U.S., although that may just wind up being the tail of the skink as these people destroy the U.S. in the next 3 years or more. But look, we're in for rough times. I just like to reemphasize that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Well, Jeff and I kind of described this in the book of towards the end, where you go down to the beach on December 26, 2004. You're in Banda Aceh, Indonesia, right? You walk out onto the beach. There's no water. Where'd all the water go? It's been sucked out, right? The beach. And for those that were there on vacation and didn't know what to make of this, they wandered down the shore into where the water had been to take pictures with the starfish.
Pick up all kinds of pretty shells that have been exposed. It was wonderful, right?
Very amazing and an unusual situation. While the animals instinctively headed for the hills, and the people that had experience that had been there recognized the signs of that and immediately headed to the hills, knowing that that was the precursor of a tsunami, that the water goes away because it's building and it's coming back. So as we stand here in the beginning of, the end of 2021, the beginning of 2022 coming, we're standing here recognizing that the water is no longer there. We're heading to higher grounds. What do you think things are going to look like when the water comes back?
We're going to have massive price rises on a retail level. We're going to have significant shortages in many areas caused for many different reasons, all at the foot of the government, but the government will use that as an excuse to step in to cure the problem that they solved. More political repression, because when the economy gets bad, when more people lose their jobs, have no savings, the stock market holdings crash, that's going to happen at some point. They'll be looking for somebody to kiss it and make it better, a politician. And he'll use that as an excuse to take even more power to himself. So we're in for tough times. So that's why you have to position yourself now for tough times. That's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line.
What you do, where you allocate your capital, where you put yourself, that's something it's up to everybody to do some research on their own. My contribution to this is my podcast, my blog, and these three novels that we talked about. Lots of others are making contributions, like Jeff, well, like yourself, for instance. But it's not enough to just listen. People have to take action.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one thing to know it's coming. It's another thing to make the moves to get out of the way. All of the links for Doug's books will be found in the description. I encourage people to go to International Man to check out what Doug is doing. Doug's pronouns are buy silver. And we appreciate you coming on the show so much and getting to the bottom of this. Thanks, Doug, for everything that you do.
Thanks, Charlie. It's been a pleasure.
All right, everybody, if you like this episode, take the additional step now of sharing it with your friends and family. It's the only way that things are going to grow. You can follow us on Twitter at macroaggressions, or you can go to the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Take care, everybody.